possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from International Galleries in Urbana's Lincoln Square Mall, offering a collection of handcrafted jewelry, including Baltic Amber, Garnets, Moonstone, Turquoise, and Czechoslovakian Crystal. International Galleries also offers artwork by regional artists, fine art prints, and custom framing. Rush service is always available.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Just let me mention very quickly that tomorrow morning we'll be talking in the 10 o'clock hour about recent changes in U.S. immigration law, and our guests will be Richard and Debbie Schell. They're both attorneys that practice immigration law. They are also the co-authors of a recently published book titled U.S. Immigration and Citizenship Q&A. Then in the second hour, the 11 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Melba Beals. She is one of nine African-American students to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. She is now a writer and public speaker, and we'll talk about her experiences. She's spending some time as a guest at Unit 1 on the U of I campus. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the life of Martin Luther. And our guest for the program is one of the country's best-known scholars of contemporary religion, Martin Marty. He's the Fairfax M. Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago Divinity School, where he taught for 35 years. He has studied and written articles on Luther for half a century. He is also an ordained minister and regular columnist for the Christian Century and is the author of more than 50 books, including a new brief biography titled Martin Luther. And this is part of the Penguin Life series, and there are a number of these books, biographies of a wide range of individuals, and the only restriction placed on the author is that the book has to be under 200 pages. It's out now in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. If people might happen to be listening in the Chicago area, he is scheduled to do a talk about Martin Luther at the Newberry Library today. So that's something that you might take advantage of. And, of course, here on the program, if you have questions, you're welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Professor Marty, thank you very much for talking with us.
Glad to represent the other Martin.
One thing I'm curious about is, and I'm not quite sure how this book series works. Were you assigned this topic, or did you choose it?
I used to just walk by them in the bookstores and lust after them and envy the authors who were in it, because they range from Mao Zedong, Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, Andy Warhol was so wide, Jane Austen, mm-hmm. Charles Dickens. And then one day I got a letter from them saying that we don't have Martin Luther. You have studied him. Would you write? They don't look for people who spend their whole life on that figure. As you introduced me, you mentioned I teach more of the 20th century, the contemporary world. But I have studied it all along. If you're too close to the subject, you are not going to even dream of boiling it down to slightly under 200 pages. So you come at it from a little distance. The other little factor is this. At the year 2000, there were various surveys made, a game, Arts and Entertainment Network, Life Magazine, etc., on the most influential people and events of the millennium. And in Life Magazine's, Martin Luther turned up third. I think he was third also in the other one. And in A&E, they had incidents, and they had the invention of printing with Gutenberg and Martin Luther's 95 Theses as the two main events of the millennium. So that was their rationale for saying, isn't it about time we do Martin Luther?
Well, not only, you have to say, not only was he responsible for launching the third major branch of Christianity, but when you look at the impact of the Reformation on politics, on history and culture, it's certainly significant.
Well, I want to be careful not to overstate the case. I noticed that in 1983, when Martin Luther was 500 years old, there was a good deal of attention paid to his life, and I went through some old clippings, and I found one from George Will that talked about how he gave birth to modern liberties, and it almost sounded as if he was at Thomas Jefferson's side. You can't overdo that. He was a medieval person. He lived in a world very different from ours, but by following conscience as he did, by standing up to both religious and secular authority as he did, by lighting a match to a fuel that was all over Europe, he certainly helped inaugurate a whole new spirit. And while he's not the single-handed founder of Protestantism, we have too many other wonderful claimants to that, without his, it's not likely to have happened. Somebody once asked me to put the Reformation in one sentence, the Lutheran Reformation, and I said it's a revolt by the junior faculty of Little Wittenberg University because they took these texts seriously, they translated the Bible, they published, and it spread.
What do we know about his parents and his childhood?
His father was a miner, M-I-N-E-R, at a time when in copper mining you took a lot of chances, and his father had some good chances, and I would say was middle class. In a later town where they lived, they always elected five citizens to represent the town to the prince, the elector, the officials, and Hans Luther was one of them. And Margarete Luther was a simple woman. I think they were literate and learned, which was kind of rare in that time. The parents have taken some tough raps later on. Martin once said that his mother rapped his knuckles till they bled because he stole a nut, and that sort of gets fixed in the brain. And then there was a very famous book by Eric Erickson some years ago on the trauma Luther experienced looking for God the Father, and he related a lot of this to Hans Luther. But I think that's overdone. All fathers in that period were tough disciplinarians, and there was real affection, and we have letters from Luther's adult life to his father that show that affection. But the most two traumatic incidents were father wanted son to become an attorney, a lawyer. That's the only kind of social security and life insurance parents had then. And then a lightning bolt came, and he was knocked to the ground, a literal lightning bolt, and he swore to St. Anne that he'd become a monk. His father was livid, furious, almost broke relations because there went their security and a life of promise. The other time was when Martin Luther served his first Mass. To this day, the priest serving a Mass takes it very seriously. You are handling bread and wine, but you're also handling the body and blood of Christ, and you're representing a door to heaven, and you're breaking through all these boundaries. And for Luther to do that, he almost went into shock when he did it. Meanwhile, his father came with 20 horses and 20 horsemen and 20 gulden for the monastery in what looked like a peace gesture. And yet at the beer party after it was over, his father said, you know, you're supposed to know the Bible so well. Don't you know one of the Ten Commandments says you should honor your father and your mother, and you dishonored me. So it was rough passages, but overall he came from a quality family and rebuilt relations.
Yeah. I find myself wondering about the thunderstorm story. He said that's the story, and he said that's what happened. Then he was caught in a thunderstorm and was almost hit by lightning, and he called out and said to St. Anne, if you save me, I will become a monk. And so I guess you have to take him at his word that that's exactly what happened, but you sort of have to wonder about the when people talk about their lives and they cite some one, just one life sort of turning event, the place where the thing turns the corner, you have to wonder, well, I guess you have to wonder about that.
Yeah, you're creatively skeptical, and I think all historians should be suspicious, and I am suspicious too. A couple of other incidents of his life that everyone knows about, I also am a little suspicious about. But I think there's something interesting here. He was building up to this for a long time. Many people in our world say they're born again by a blinding flash. But the more you study the autobiographies, you can see something was leading up to it a long time. Almost nobody ever turns on television and hears an evangelist cold, as if you came from Siberia and you get born again. Your husband or wife has been nagging you. You've been looking. You've been reading. You've been doing all these things. And Luther was of that sort. He was really writhing in the writhing in his study, becoming a lawyer. And he even said that at that time he had such a sense of guilt and fear and smallness in the universe that, quote, the trembling of a leaf could throw me into fear. So it didn't have to be a huge lightning bolt to make a difference. But that is the night that he did swear this. When he left his parents' home, it wasn't on his mind. And when he got to the town of Erfurt, his university, he had changed. And I think why it's hard for you and me and a lot of people of our time to picture this is we don't live in a world that they lived in, which was populated by witches and ghosts and poltergeists and devils and all that. And you always felt that other order was impinging on you. The people of his town all believed that there were poltergeists and ghosts up in the mountains around them. So you're living with that all the time. And then when you get one clear lightning blast, you probably think, maybe God's trying to tell me something. Hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Martin Marty. He is the author of a new brief biography of Martin Luther. It's published by Viking, part of their brief biography series. He is a Fairfax Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago, where he taught religious history for over 35 years and has written many books. This is just one of them. If you're interested in finding out more about the life of Martin Luther, you could seek out the book and it fit right in your pocket. Also, there are a number of other books in this series, and it's quite an interesting enterprise, the idea of producing a series of short biographies covering people in the world of history figures, people in religion, people in popular culture, and it's very interesting. Very interesting book, an interesting sort of project. Questions also are welcome here if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Eureka on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
An honor to speak with you, Dr. Marty. Two short questions, please.
Yes.
It is my understanding that somewhere in the things attributed to Luther, he made a statement saying that he wanted all of the synagogues in Germany torn down or burned down. Is there anything close to that?
Yes.
Writings?
Yes. The worst thing one could dig up on Luther, and it's really bad, is that in his last years, sharing the cultural climate of his day, but he had more power than a lot of mere critics, he wrote a couple of very angry tracts, sad tracts. Now, let me explain them without defending them. They aren't anti-Semitic in the modern sense, in that he didn't single out Jews as a race, as a people. He singled them out as a religion. But in that world, maybe that was worse. In other words, no more than anyone else, and maybe less than many, he didn't make much of the cultural side. Yes, they were usurers, they took too high interest, but he didn't think anybody should take interest. He had a few of those things, but he grew up friendly to them. When he was translating the Bible, he would talk to the butcher and ask, what's the German word for this Hebrew word of the part of the cow, and so on. So what turned him? What made him so bad at the end, unjustifiably so? He thought that nobody was more ready to become Christian than Jews, and a few did, and he welcomed them, which again proves it wasn't racial. But he thought because they have the Hebrew scriptures, which to the Christian was the Old Testament, Luther saw that all prefiguring Christ. Almost every page of the Old Testament, he thought, was leaning toward Christ. And then when Christ came, he thought that the church of 15 centuries had made it hard to get to love Christ. And so as soon as his teachings would come out and the Bible translation would be there, he thought Jews would come running and they would all become Christian. And again, almost nobody did. So he attacked mainly rabbis. And there were no burnings near him. But he used language of the inflammatory sort that was all over Europe at that time. And when princes and magistrates called for it, he said, yes, go to it. Burn the synagogues and burn the rabbis' houses, because he thought the rabbis had a portable version of the faith and people would keep finding them.
I see.
So, no justification.
Uh-huh. my second question is, it's my understanding that during the Peasants' Rebellion or Uprising, Luther pretty much took the side of the, I guess, the princes. Is that right?
Yes. Boy, you hit the two things on the nail that that's very hard to piece our way through. The peasant thing is more explainable, a little more justifiable, but not the way Luther then struck out. So I'll try to explain that quickly. Anytime I tour East Germany, or almost anywhere in Europe, but East Germany, on every hilltop there's a castle. And these castles were feudal lords, they were knights, and so on. And they were the only thing that was called order. There was no Germany. There were 300 separate principalities. So it was really at the edge of chaos, and everyone's fighting everybody, and these princes were supposed to be just. He wrote a great deal on how they should be just and fair-minded. Well, around them were peasants, sometimes people in cities, weaving industry and so on, who were really suffering. The lords kept gouging them more and more, and some of them organized. Now, there was no chance in the world that the peasants could actually unseat the princes. Princes had all the artillery, if you want to call it that, and the peasants had pitchforks. But a couple of preachers who started out friends of Luther, most notably Thomas Münzer, moved to his left and believed that they were bringing in the kingdom of God and the peasants should rise and be the new kingdom. And the peasants did, and a lot of people were getting killed on both sides, but Luther thought the way to bring peace was to tell the princes to smite and stab the peasants, which they were all too ready to do. A little later, then, he wrote strong tracts about the princes misusing their authority, but by then there were a lot of dead people. So the Peasants' Revolt alongside the Jewish thing are the two main marks against Luther from our viewpoint in the modern world. In 1983, when I was in East Germany, it was interesting because for six more years the communists were in power, and in every town square you saw three pictures, Lenin, Luther, and Thomas Münzer. Lenin, of course, had to be there, and the people were all but ready to spit on the money, but you know that wasn't going to last very long. Luther was to be the hero of individual liberty, and Münzer was the liberator of the corporate body, kind of a Christian antecedent, violent communist. So those three. So I brought three little buttons home with their pictures on. Once in a while, I'd wear them on my Mao cap and see what people thought of me in that mix.
Thank you very much, Doug.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. We'll go on here to a caller in, I believe, in Champaign. Yes, on line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. Mm-hmm. My memory may be a little bit fuzzy, but is it possible that you were teaching at the high school level back in the early 50s?
That's my brother, who may be listening. He lives near Champaign. We look like each other. We both wear bow ties, have the same few hair. We're both historians. We sometimes sign each other's books for people, and that's the one you're talking about.
All right. Thank you so much. He was then my religion teacher in Chicago.
Well, your memory isn't fuzzy, and you sound like you turned out all right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Do you think that Luther was had more than what would have been the average intellectual capacity for a man of his time?
Oh, yeah. There he was astonishing. You almost have to think of him the way you think of Mozart in music and Shakespeare in literature, for the encompassing way he went about. He translated the Bible, and he all but knew it from memory in his writings, which make up 110 thick, small print volumes in German. There are 55 volumes in English. He often quotes 10, 12, 15 Bible verses. He'll say Deuteronomy 24, 6 and Joshua 3, 2. You look them up and he'll get one of them a little bit wrong. He had a good education. Erfurt was one of the prime universities of the day, and he learned the classics. The first things he published were some medieval Catholic mystical writings. But even the last piece of paper we have from him, he's making reference to the poet Virgil. So he had that astonishing scope, and A Gift with Words. His Bible translation is to German what Shakespeare and the King James Bible are to English. Maybe even better, because he had such an earthy, concrete way that's closer to the Hebrew than most English translations are. So on those levels, astonishing. Now, to qualify that, let me say he was not a systematic scholar. His counterpart, Desiderius Erasmus, was. The slightly later reformer in Switzerland, John Calvin, was. Luther was too explosive, too random, all over the place. He would always say what came to his mind, and you don't do that when you're a systematic scholar. Again, he was a genius at fusing his own experience with the long biblical and Catholic history and perception of the world around him.
I would think we have another caller here, also in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Am I on?
Yes.
Dr. Marty, you have recounted one of the several famous stories about Dr. Luther, namely the Stotternheim experience, where the patron saint of miners is said to have appeared to him. There is the possibility of of arguing that that's one of the many jokes that Luther made at the table, but and one could go into that. But, of course, there are three other great Luther stories, namely the nailing of the theses, the tower experience where he discovered the gospel, and, of course, the his appearance at the Diet of Worms, where he made the legendary, very famous remark, "Here I stand, I can do no differently." Would you care to comment on any of those other three
Luther stories? I'll be glad to. And you sound like Mr. Inge did at the beginning of the program, creatively skeptical, because historians are detectives, and we're not supposed to just...
Well, he told a lot of good stories at table.
Oh, yeah, he did. In fact, some of the more notorious things he said, and the most colorful and the funniest, are in three volumes of what's called Tischreden, Table Talk. He and his wife, Catherine, sort of ran a fraternity house. There were always students around, and after dinner, they'd talk, and then the students would go home and write down these gems that their mentor had said, and they sometimes got it accurate and sometimes didn't, so you can't tell. But the three you're pointing to are anchored much more in history, and I think the Stotternheim thing did happen. The question is, as Mr. Inge said, was it the single decisive thing, or was it just a climax of a lot of others? He didn't have an apparition of St. Anne. He prayed to her. She wasn't visible to him in a vision. Now, the other three. First, the nailing of the 95 Theses. If there's anything else people know about Luther, it's that. And most Luther sculptures have that. I've won a couple Luther awards, and I have nice little statues in my house of Luther nailing up theses. One of them left-handed. I think the sculptor used the wrong die. Well, maybe it was left-handed. Who knows? The point is, Luther never said he nailed up the theses. In fact, some years ago, there was a book by Erwin Iserlo, a German Catholic scholar, saying the theses were not posted. And the American publisher asked me to write a foreword to it, and I went over all the evidence, and I said, well, they were posted in the sense that he went to the post office, in that we know he sent them to the Archbishop of Mainz, who was his superior in the Catholic Church, a very, very powerful archbishop. And he sent them to him, thinking that the archbishop would agree with them. It's quite likely that he did nail them to the door at Wittenberg because it was a bulletin board. We do know that the purpose of these theses were to have scholars debate them. And I'm sitting on the University of Chicago campus. I walk past the bulletin board, and it's layer upon layer of postings of what goes on. And he put his up there. He wanted a debate. I've always taken great comfort from the fact, as somebody who's always worried, will I outnumber the audience, that he posted a debate about the theses and not a single person showed up. My theory is that the Wittenberg faculty already by 1517 thought this was old stuff. That is, they agreed with him. Why debate it? And it was too obscure. Wittenberg was a little tiny town of 2,000 people out in the sticks, and who would bother with that? But The big one was the Archbishop. The Archbishop had been very ambitious. In those days, you were supposed to only be bishop of one see, like there's a bishop of Peoria, the bishop of Chicago, bishop of Joliet. Well, Mainz wanted several of these, and the only way to get them was to buy them. The Vatican would sell them at huge prices, and he had to borrow from the Fugger banking family, the J.P. Morgans of their day, and was deeply in debt and helped cook up this scheme of selling indulgences. And that was the trigger event that led Luther to put up the theses. So we know he did theses. We know they were debated. We know they were published very soon, and it was the published version that made the impact, not the debate. Number two was the Tower experience. Here, Luther writes about this 30 years later, and if you'd quiz me about things I did in the 60s, they'd all be true, but they'd be colored, they'd be shaped, they'd be styled, if you will. And so he gives three different dates for it happening. It's a retrospect. Something did happen. Here's what was happening. For several years, he'd been, as a professor, lecturing, first on the Psalms, and then on the writings of Paul the Apostle, particularly the book of Romans. And he had a particular issue we can get to on somebody else's question if you want that was he was struggling with, was the heart of his thought. And he says that he finally came to clarity on it one day when reading one passage in the book of Romans. And then he added a little thing that he was in CL period. And Eric Erickson, about whom I referred to before, psychoanalyst, said that has to be the cloaca, which means the latrine. Luther was rather privileged. He was kind of a second-in-command sort, and so he got a warm room in the monastery. No, not everybody did. And it was up near the tower, and it was near the latrine, which needed gravity. But most scholars today say that grammatically that doesn't work. It meant in the cloister. And Erickson's book is probably based on a misinterpretation of where it happened. But that he had some sense suddenly that what he'd been studying for 10 years all added up is probably the case. The third and last one is the other great moment in his life. They tried to put him down. Archbishop of Mainz couldn't do it. What Luther was fortunate in was that the princes backed him. Again, we didn't have Germany yet, but he had all these princes, and his own was named Frederick the Wise. There's a new film out on Luther, and Frederick the Wise is played wonderfully by Peter Ustinov. The two never met, but in the movie they do meet, and it was a nice scene. He backed him all the way. You have to remember, the people north of the Alps hated the Pope. They hated the hierarchy. They wanted to build churches where they were, and here their money is going over the Alps. And I have pictures, for example, of carvings, formal artist carvings at the end of church pews in which hell is there. It's the jaws of Satan and flames, and the people are pushing the Pope down that throat. So Luther had that on his side. The Pope had to act. The princes mainly are backing him, the archbishops against him, and then the Holy Roman Empire, which was basically Spain and today's Germany, had the emperor. And the emperor tried to put him down, and there was a diet, an imperial assembly, at the town of Augsburg. And Luther was there. I mean, at Worms, I'm sorry, Worms. There was another diet at Augsburg, but let's get our diets right. The Diet of Worms, Cathedral City, and here you had the imperial power. You had the Vatican papal, rather, representatives there, and they put a pile of his books on the table. Luther published about 30 pages every 14 days of his life. The publishers just seized everything he said and published it. So there was a mountain of books already by 1520. And did you write all these? Well, he looked at him, yeah. Well, you must recant. You must take them back. He said, well, I can't recant them. Some of them are just plain quotations from the Bible. How can I take back the Bible? Some of them are on trivial matters, and he had to admit they were trivial. But the heart of it all, give me a day to think. This puzzled all his supporters because they knew what he was going to do, but he did think, and the next day he did say his most famous sentence, that unless I am convinced by Scripture and sound reason, I cannot go against conscience, and so I cannot withdraw. I cannot recant. And then some people heard him say, here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God. That little bit to get back to your question, is less certifiable than all the rest that he could not recant. But "Here I Stand" became his most famous line, whether he said it exactly that way or not. Remember, we didn't have court reporters. We had people talking later on. But "Here I Stand," and that was the title of a fine biography of him 60 years ago by Roland Bainton. And this year, with all the Luther mania going on, people send me things, a bobblehead of Luther and Luther's beer with the label Sin Boldly, and I got some black socks, and it says, "Here stehe ich, here I stand." So my black socks are part of it. Every figure like this has some mythic character, and these all are based on incidents that are probably embellished. Hmm.
Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Martin Marty. He's Fairfax Cohn Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago Divinity School, where he taught for 35 years and has written a lot about Luther and other subjects. He's the author of more than 50 books. He's the author of a recently published brief biography of Luther that's part of the Penguin Lives series of brief biographies. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I think the only rule here for the people who write the books is that they can't be any more than 200 pages long. It's just out now. It's published by Viking, and if you're interested, you can seek it out in the bookstore. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I have some other callers here I want to get to. I want to talk about one sort of fundamental point. Does it seem that the one thing that's at the center of Luther's life is the fact that he was consumed by, obsessed with his relationship with God, and not in an abstract way at all. He was very consumed with this idea of a personal relationship with God. And it seemed that to me, from what I remember of my Lutheran boyhood, that's really the key here, a key idea within Protestantism. That is, that such a thing is possible and that no one need mediate it for you. What do you think? Why? Why do you think that he was so consumed with his relationship with God in that way, that direct sort of way?
Well, you framed it well, and I have to say, like the man before who wasn't sure of his memory about my brother teaching him in high school, your Lutheran boyhood teaching stuck, because this is the central point, and I'll spend a minute or two on it. Luther was by no means the only person worried about his relation to God. We have to remember that he lived in a world where God was a threatening judge, so close to you that any moment you could be wiped out. And you face eternity in hell or hundreds of thousands of years in purgatory, which wasn't a very pleasant place. And so a lot of people were concerned about it. But through the years, the church had developed a system that kind of took the worst pressure off it, in that by going to Mass, by going on pilgrimages, by adoring relics, by making contributions, by trying to do good works, you could add up a lot of merits, and that would reduce your time in purgatory and get you to heaven. And the great saints helped out because they had piled up so many virtues that you could draw on them. Now, hundreds of thousands of people in the Middle Ages shared that same concern about how they stood with God, but they were using that system only, in Luther's view. And any Catholic historian today would also say the system had gone bad. It had become a commercial transaction. It was corrupt. It was money being used for all kinds of bad purposes. People were really threatened. Thus, if my prince offends the Pope can excommunicate him. He can't go to heaven. But he can also issue an interdict, which meant that no priest could serve Mass to the people. And if they die, they'd go to hell or purgatory. And that's a terribly powerful political instrument. So, as I say, Catholic historians, all historians, share a sense that that had gone wrong. I'm starting that way by saying Luther wasn't the only one concerned. But when he studied the Book of Romans and so on, he got the insight that all that piling up of pilgrimages and relics and merits and works didn't add up to anything at all. How did you know that at your best you were doing even a minimum to please God? And he reads all these writings in the Psalms, and particularly in Paul the Apostle, that say it's not the works. Works follow grace and faith. When you know you are in God's care, you are supposed to act in love and be good. Luther was quite a moralist and did a lot with the Ten Commandments on that level. But it couldn't get you right with God. And the technical word was contrition. He could be contrite, which meant sorry for your sins, but he became kind of a virtuoso at being contrite. His poor successor would yawn through 6 hours of confession because Luther wanted to be sure he was contrite enough. Then it dawned on him that contrition was still a way to try to please God. I'm more contrite than you are, he could say to other people. So this issuance that the fundamental character of God in the Bible is that God is love and that God wills the salvation of all people, the God who created them wants them back, and that the gift of God's love in Christ, God joyfully exchanges, Luther's favorite word. The things that we were, Christ took on. He became a human who had to die. The things that he was and is, we get to take on, namely life and the love of God. And that was the big theme, and that just caught on. There were so many people resentful of the old system, hungry for what he had, though more moderately. Again, if he was a kind of a genius in his own way, it was a genius at exploring his inner life, and most of us don't go that deep that long. But that was his central theme.
Let us talk with some others, and we'll go next to someone in Champaign County on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I might have missed this, but there's one matter I wanted to bring up and hear what Professor Marty has to say. I read a number of sources about Martin Luther's anti-Semitism, and especially his involvement with some of the, I don't know if you call them princes or whatever, who were involved in various Jewish persecutions and even pogroms, and I wonder if you'd know about this, and if you can explore it a little bit.
Yeah, we did actually talk about that with an earlier caller, but I want to give Dr. Marty again a chance to go over that ground again. Yeah, sure.
Well, have to be highly condensed. You are right. His late writings are obscene, blasphemous, outrageous, manic. But they're not racially anti-Semitic. It isn't that you were born a Jew. It is that you didn't convert to Christianity. And any Jew who converted to Christianity was his best pal. He was ready for that. But he believed that the Jews should have led everybody else back to the gospel of Jesus because Jesus was one of their rabbis, and the church had obscured that. And now that they had the Bible clear, he thought they'd all come running, and they didn't. And therefore, he, with some princes, wanted to strike out at them. Again, the climate in Europe was so pervasively this. Erasmus, the very gentle soul, on my office wall I always had pictures of Luther and Erasmus. Erasmus said, oh, I envy you, France, because you don't have Jews. You could go right down the line, and it's very hard to find people who weren't involved. But I think Luther should be held more responsible because of the tremendous rhetorical power he had and the followers he had. For the rest, I don't. We went on about 5 minutes before, but just say that I'm sworn never to justify anything he did on that front.
Thank you.
All right. Another Champaign County caller. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to revisit the peasant war, and but on the last subject, it seems that this whole business about the synoptic gospels sequentially being more and more against the Jews and less against the Romans was, I think I haven't studied it, but I think I'm persuaded that this was displacing the antagonism sort of thing, and that's the way anti-Semitism has been used for quite a long time, I think. I don't know. That's not theological, or I don't know if they have anything in Luther's life that relates to that. But what I wanted to get back to was you mentioned that Luther's acquaintance or colleague moved to the left, but isn't it also could be said that Luther, of course, did move to the right? And what I'm getting at is that, as well as being against, you know, the crassness of the Medici popes and the and selling of indulgences, he was against the way the church's authority was used by the very princes that he eventually backed. It seemed the way the structure of authority was. That the fact that was being challenged, the breakdown, obviously set a lot of things free, it seems to me, in the culture of the time. But isn't it true that he was authentically for you know, as well as being against the abuses of the church and what I just pointed to, but he was actually for a better lot for the poor, whose situation he identified with. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he was entirely a theologically based Reformation, but it seems to me that he regretted what he had unleashed in some ways, but at the same time, I think there were at the beginning. I think I'm repeating myself, and I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay,
answer,
it's a good theme. I'll do my best. I think you're right. He was the poor people's man, town after town. When he came, it was a festival. One of the reasons that he didn't get killed was that he was too popular. And these were people who were basically poor and illiterate and so on. He was a man of the people, there's no doubt about it. I think what happened was, as a Chicagoan, I like to compare to 1968, to him and to the princes, the peasant uprising looked a lot like the weatherman looked to us. So if you were a liberal, and I was a liberal in Chicago, you were really being attacked by the weatherman, and you were nervous about the weatherman, and you wanted to get them out of the way so you could get back to ordinary left and right in politics, which is not killing. And so that's where he was frantic. If you take two A's, authoritarianism and anarchy, and position between them, he hated authoritarianism in church and state, and he was totally afraid of anarchism, and he was an inch or two closer to fear of anarchism than he was to fear of authoritarianism. But, he wrote books to the Christian nobility that was really strong attacks on them for not sharing with the poor, for their policies. He's not a very good justifier of capitalism. He didn't like the way they were taking interest. He fought the grain merchants. He did all these things. So he was definitely a friend of the poor. But during that war itself, he bet on authority, just as, again, authority bet on the weathermen. Luther, in the end, played up pretty close to the princes. He was against having priests be ordained by the bishops that were there. Well, he wasn't really against it. The bishops wouldn't ordain to get new ministers. And to be ordained by them made you a junior officer of the Holy Roman Empire, which you didn't want. And the bishops were corrupt. Well, who's going to run the church? And he turned to the princes, which is quite a mistake too, but there was nobody else to run it at the time. And for that reason, the churches in Germany and to some extent in Scandinavia, the heartland of the Lutheran Reformation, the churches were often kind of supine and too deferential to authority, and that's partly his problem. But again, it's hard to fit our way back into that world where there was no other structure of authority. I'll say one other thing about the princes and why Luther wasn't killed, because for the last 25 years of his life, he was under a death sentence. Somebody said the Turks, the Muslims, are Luther's luck, because the Turks, they called them, the Muslims, the Mohammedans, had come up past Constantinople. They had taken Budapest. They're at the door of Vienna, and great fear that they're soon going to crash into Germany. And the Vatican, I keep saying Vatican, I mean the Pope, the papal princes, who had their own armies, were very nervous about this, and they didn't dare kill the hero of these German princes. So they stood up together. Then the German princes asked Luther to pray for their victory over the Turk, and he didn't turn out to be a very good chaplain for the White House, because he prayed, it takes one rascal to kill another rascal. God is probably using the Turk to punish us Germans for our drunkenness and our licentiousness and our selfishness and our corruption. So if God is using them to punish us, may he punish us graciously. That is, don't let it hurt much. So he was definitely against holy war against the Muslim. He was absolutely opposed to a crusade. You might have to fight a defensive war, and in the end he supported it, but you dare not call it a holy war.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller. This is Champagne Line 3.
Good morning, sir.
Yes.
Speaking back to Luther's credo, the artist Ben Shawn, the lithographer way, way back, made several versions of a piece which he called Credo, which his quote at least is very moving. It's, "I have the right to believe freely, to be a slave to no man's authority. If this be heresy, so be it. It is still the truth. To go against conscience is neither right nor safe. Here I stand. No man can correct my consciousness.
Yes, well, that's beautiful, and it's at the heart of his expressions of freedom. It hangs on my bedroom wall, and I got it from a poster from Neiman Marcus, Mr. Marcus.
Maybe,
yes.
Yes.
Maybe you have the same one, then.
Yes.
And I thought it's very interesting that a celebrated Jew chose this as his passage to send out to people a voice of freedom.
Well, also, he did the Time magazine woodcut cover for Martin Luther King.
Yes, right. Yeah, I mean, the artist Ben Shahn was a Jew and loved Luther on freedom, and Marcus of Neiman Marcus, a Jew, loved Luther on freedom. Mm-hmm. You could take these passages, and they really are banners to put forth before the world. It wasn't a finished product. You still needed the Enlightenment, you needed modernity, you needed America's founding fathers and so on to bring it all about. But the germ was there, and if you want to write a history of the expression of conscience, I think that's one of the things that put Luther in that top five among the millennium figures. Thanks for reading it.
Oh, no, I memorized it.
Well, I haven't, so you got one up on me. Great.
Thank you, sir.
All right, well, thank you. We'll go to another caller up here, Bloomington, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Those are beautiful words, and they sound very brave. But would you comment on Luther's conscience? When he made those words, when he made that statement, he was conscious of John Huss. He was he was about to be burned at the stake. As I understand, when he made those comments, there were even shouts from the gallery, "Burn him, burn him." Would you comment on that?
Yes, indeed. You got it right. Jan Hus, to whom you're referring, was 1415. He was a Bohemian reformer. In fact, spiritual descendants of Jan Hus are in Bohemia and in America. Hussites, Utraquists, Bohemian Brethren, and some of the Reformed Protestants trace their roots back to this amazing man. And at the Council of Constance, he was given protection. You come, testify, and you'll be safe. And he came, and they burned him. By the way, the name Hus in German or Bohemian meant goose. And Luther often referred back to, they thought they killed that goose, but now they have a swan 100 years later. He had a great admiration for Hus and for quite a number of other people who had been in the Catholic Church, who had been reforming for the century before. And yes, town after town where Luther would go, the ordinary people would come out in great numbers, but still authority would be there, and they knew law and order. This man, you could kill him with impunity any day of his last 26 years of his life. And so when he said those words, somebody asked me recently, I knew Martin Luther King in a way, and they said, did you ever compare your names, both being Martin, and did you ever talk to him about him being Martin Luther? And I said, no, we never did. But in a certain sense, the credibility of Martin Luther King came in part because we all knew someday he'd be killed in the venture. And I think that's what gave some of the credibility to Luther, that his life was on the line every adult day.
Hmm. Chicago next, or another caller here, line four. Hello.
I wonder if there's anything to Luther, or at least Lutheranism, connected to the rise of German identity, and also, of course, Northern European, anti-Mediterranean sentiment. And lastly, I wonder if you've ever thought there is a paradox in Luther, who, as you pointed out, is a figure who stands and personifies stand against the old order, and yet the Lutheran Church becomes somewhat subject to the German prince's authoritarianism. And lastly, I was wondering if you could tell us what are the difficulties of writing a biography limited to 200 pages?
Okay, I'll try to push this all together in a hurry. Great. Good question, too. There's no doubt about it that Luther's teaching, picked up by his heirs, made the German churches kind of Department of State and rather subject. He liked to quote Romans 13, that God had put authority in place, and to resist authority was to resist God, although he resisted the emperor himself and resisted plenty of princes. He said if it was against conscience, against gospel, you had to resist. But in general, there was an authoritarianism in the German life. Whether this goes into the makeup of the German character, I don't know. In a certain way, part of your question about the Northern, Henry VIII's churchmen, church people of what is today Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Iceland, Finland, the church people of the Netherlands, Belgium, all of Northern Europe, do have a very different characteristic, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, than does the Mediterranean style. More agony of conscience, more seriousness. At Second Vatican Council, I had dinner one night with five Spanish bishops, and they were so mystified that I, a Lutheran, wouldn't eat meat on Friday, and the Benedictine monk from America, Catholic, also wouldn't. And that's how you Americans are. The Catholics you got are from Northern Europe, and they all are trying to follow all these laws. We have a good time. There's a very sunny character to the Mediterranean Catholicism that's different in all the reformations of the North, and Luther certainly had a big part of that. Finally, about writing, compressing this, you have to decide who your character is. I finally decided to take readers very seriously and say, let's not pretend that Luther is a national hero. Let's not pretend he's a musician, though he was a good one. Let's know what he thought he was about, kind of a God-obsessed character trying to figure a path for this, which means you have to treat him as a theologian, namely somebody who had words about God. And I tell up front, if I were writing about sports figures, I have to draw people into that world. You have to explain, because we don't live in his world. But you pick that. And I chose his identification with the patriarch Jacob, who wrestles one night at the brook Jabbok. And toward morning, the other figure says to him, "Let me go. I won't let you go unless you bless me." This is Luther seeing himself wrestling with God. And in the end, they're both pooped. The other figure has given him a wound and the new name Israel. And Jacob has worn the other one down. And the other figure, the Hebrew word is ish, which means human. But that figure says, you have wrestled with God and the human, and you have won. And Luther says, I don't mean that the God who made the universe is reduced by me, but the God who could annihilate me wrestles with me, and I get to win. And I made that the central theme and let all the rest of the book grow out of it. I like to tell stories, and so it's very much a story kind of thing. And people sell these at airport bookstands, and I hope that they'll pick it up like I picked up Da Vinci and Dante and others in the series and read it on a plane and find it, I think even entertaining and amusing. But also, I'd like to think that secular people, people of other religions, Buddhists who pick it up, would not identify with Luther's God. They're not going to do that. But they would identify with some dimensions of his struggle and liberation.
There we'll have to leave it. Dr. Marty, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
I enjoy the chance. Thank you.
Our guest, Martin Marty. He is Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago Divinity School. The book is Martin Luther, A Penguin Life, and it's published by Viking. Programs here made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom-designed gemstone roundtables, conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us on